Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 22nd of July 2012. My name's T.R.P. Watson, and this week I'm joined by Phil from the West End Whingers, Johnny Fox and Web Cowgirl. We're now going to talk about Posh, which is on at the Duke of York's Theatre. It was first produced in 2010. This is a play by Laura Wade, and it's about a fictional Oxford student dining club called the Riot Club. It is a fictionalised version, they say, of the Bullingdon Club, which has had people like David Cameron, George Osborne and Boris Johnson as members. It was also fictionalised, the Bullingdon Club was also fictionalised in Evelyn Waugh's Decline and Fall as the Buller Club. The people in the Bullingdon and indeed the Riot Club tend to dress up in sort of fancy waistcoats and usually cause a bit of a mess and a bit of sort of loud behaviour and occasional destruction of property. But they seem to think that so long as they pay money, so long as they, you know, settle the debt, settle the money, everything, you know, money will solve absolutely everything. So they seem to take that kind of attitude to life. In this play, the Riot Club have decided to rent out a country pub's dining room to have their dinner. One person's leaving it, not quite happy with the club, and is trying to keep things under control, but not doing terribly well at it. And it ends with them really getting more and more boisterous until there is a physical assault on somebody, and they basically pick on one of the loudest people and get him to take the fall for it. We see, and there's then an epilogue where we see the person who's taken the fall and what he'll do later. Now, I believe this has been changed since it was first produced in 2010. It was just before the election, so they didn't have the government. Now they've got the coalition, so they've changed it slightly. And they've also, in the scene changes, we get a cappella songs sung by the cast, and they've also changed one or two of the a cappella songs. Now, neither of you, John and Phil, saw this first play. So, Phil, would you like to tell me what you thought of this?
Oh, I absolutely loved it. I thought it was hilarious. I was completely gripped to what was going to happen next. It is appalling. They are absolutely appalling. It's very difficult to have sympathy for the characters. And I agree that the end is a little bit fanciful, although, yeah, as you say, it's apparently been changed slightly and toned down. And you did see occasional glimpses of humanity in the first act, less in the second act. I think to make it perhaps a little bit more realistic, and some of them do have some sort of soul in there, but they are a bunch of absolute appalling twats. And yeah, I mean, it was. I just loved every minute of it. The violence that erupts, you can sort of see coming, because it's the first act is pretty extreme, so you know the second act is going to be even darker and more extreme. But I don't know. I just thought it was an absolute must-see play.
Yeah, we have many of the same cast, don't we? I mean, people like Leah Bill and Joshua Maguire as two of the more important people, and also Tom Milson as the head of the club. John, what did you think about it?
Joshua Maguire was off the night I saw it, and I would say whoever the understudy was absolutely seamless, perfect performance. I also really, really enjoyed Leo Bill's performance as Alistair Ryle, the man who eventually takes the fall, takes one for the team, if you like. But his tremendous transition from aggrandizement and aggression and patrician bluster at the beginning to the what Harry Enfield would call farty when he finds out that the consequences of his actions is beautifully written and superbly well acted. I mean, it really is. I agree with Phil. It's a must see. It's a fantastic piece of writing. I'm not sure it's a fantastic piece of satire. I think it might be faintly accurate, but I'm not sure that Laura Wade have that much insight into what goes on in gentlemen's clubs of this variety. I'm not sure how she did her research, who she slept with to get the information. So I think it's a bit more imagined than actual. And I would have liked a little bit more verisimilitude about it. There are times when their activity sounds more like a rugby club event rather than something more sinister, more patrician, more higher echelon. And some of their speech patterns didn't sound completely right to me. But I'm picking really, really tiny holes in what I thought was an excellent piece of work. I really, really enjoyed it. It's one of the few plays I've actually paid to see this year.
Get you. £10 if you want to sit in the front two rows, which is a bit too close, particularly for the after there's a shortish first scene, which transforms to the second scene very well. With the it'd be a shame to give it away, but it's to do with the paintings which are on the club wall behind them before they move to the dining room in the gastro pub. And I agree, brilliantly acted. The writing is very, very good. Very funny. I think the end, the last scene when we're back in the club, does sort of stretch credibility somewhat, but you can see what she's getting at.
I don't think it's giving anything away to say what she gets at. There's a wonderful character in the play, played by Sir Simon Shepherd, as they call him in Gimme Gimme Gimme, who is the godfather of one of the boys in the club, and he's now a member of parliament, or possibly a peer. No, he's a peer. That's right, and has a lot of influence. I think what they're talking about is that it is possible, if you know the right people and they know the right lawyers, not to reap the consequences of things you do. And that seems to me, be careful what I say, the fear of libel, but you know, in the cases of people like Rebecca Wade, whatever her name is now, there does seem to be ways round owning up to everything you've done and being punished for it. And that's a very interesting point that the play makes. I think it's still quite relevant.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting because I think it's sort of unlikely that the press wouldn't discover what had been going on, given that there's enough people that see the events in the second act for it to be kept completely quiet. But I think the point is that it can be done. I think in these circumstances it would be, and possibly with a post-Leveson press, you know, they would be a bit more careful about what they reveal. So maybe it's even more timely.
I think it's the message is that you can keep things out of the press as well, and yeah, that it's possible.
Yeah, one of the things I found interesting when I originally saw this play, and there's sort of something that people were saying last year when we had the big riots, what was the difference between these rioters and these looters and people like the Bullingdon Club, which of course David Cameron was a member, and I think that to a certain extent that the difference is that they wear, you know, the Bullingdon, people like the Bullingdon Club or the Riot Club in this case, they wear a uniform, they can be easily identified, and they always pay up, they always pay for their damage, but that is the only difference. They are still, you know, they're still thugs, and they're still,
yeah,
and they still should be punished in a way. And actually, I believe the Bullingdon Club has got an ASBO in 2009, so it's not, you know, I don't know that they're quite as high on the hog as they used to be.
It's a fine line, isn't it, between the thuggery of the rioting and the thing. Well, in fact, it's no line at all, really. But as you say, it's just that they can afford to pay or have ways of getting out of it if you're in certain positions.
One thing I did want to just pick up on was the way the women characters are written. There are two in the play. One is a quite well-educated girl who's got a vacation job as a waitress in her father's gastro pub, and the other is the call girl hired for the evening by one of the guys in the club, who then declines to perform any services. I thought the student was really well written, but the prostitute not. I felt that was a bit of polemic coming from Laura Wade that didn't seem at all accurate or realistic.
We're now going to talk about St. John's Night, which is on at the German Street Theatre. in translation by James McFarlane. This is an early Ibsen play, 1853 or thereabouts, and it's a rather light piece and a rather slight piece, and it seems he didn't really like it. He left it out of his collected plays later in life, and I think it got rather bad reviews at the time. This production, directed by Anthony Biggs, has got moderately good reviews. I mean, one or two people have been rather sniffy about it, but most people say that it's a decent version of a not very good play. And I think I'd go along with that. I have to say I spent most of my time thinking this can't possibly be Ibsen. It's far too silly. Because it is a light play full of mistakes and sudden recognitions and things like that. It concerns we are around a house owned by Mrs. Berg with her daughter and her stepdaughter, the daughter of the original owner of the house. There's also her grandfather, the grandfather of the house. This is the grandfather of the stepdaughter. Introduce some names. We have Anne, who is the stepdaughter, and Mr. Berg, who's her grandfather. And he's always filled her head with lots of rumours and stories and folklore and things about goblins. And we meet the goblins, and they decide to play a trick on the inhabitants of this house. Among the inhabitants we are added Burke, who is the secret fiance of the daughter Julianne, and Jürgen, the Julianne's brother and daughter of son Mrs. Berg, and a rather wonderfully played Paulson, who is a sort of rather strange poet. He's played by Danny Lee Winter in a rather ridiculous wig, but I think in many ways he really makes this play, and his performance is something that for me, you know, rescued anything that made me worry that I wasn't seeing something that was particularly good. They take a very light touch in this play with it, and they have a lot of fun with it, which I don't think Ibsen perhaps would have approved of, but this is really quite enjoyable. What happens essentially is that the various people in the play sort of pair up. We get a pair of Burke and Anne and Julianne and Paulson, and they go off to witness the celebrations on St. John's Night, which is around about the 24th of June. Yep. It's towards midsummer, but not actually midsummer. And there's a big fire up on a mountain, and they are drugged by a wicked goblin, perhaps not a wicked goblin, but a mischievous goblin, and he drugs them to make them see the truth, or simply to go to sleep, I think is the general idea. And it's all kind of like a little fairy story or a folk tale, and it all comes out nicely in the end. Delighted is perhaps a little bit too strong. I could certainly see, you know, the faults in the play, but it's nicely done, I thought. What did you think about it, Web Cowgirl?
Well, I went and saw this with another friend who is an Ibsen fanatic like I am, and we were thrilled to be able to see a play which had never before been done in England. Although I have to say, after Emperor and Galilean, I began to think that maybe the reason why this play hadn't been done here was because it really just wasn't very good. But in the intimate confines of the German, I actually found it really charming. We thought it was funny. And I had no concept at all of what the show was going to be about, because I didn't want to know. I wanted it to be a surprise. I wanted to discover the play when I saw it. And what it all felt to me like was basically seeing a play that was a fairy tale. And this is pretty appropriate, I discovered later, because it is supposed to be inspired by A Midsummer Night's Dream. But it wasn't just it wasn't just about an encounter between people and fairies. It was actually sort of an encounter between Norway's modern, future and its past. And Ibsen actually comes out in this play on the side of the people who wanted to value Norway's traditions. And he in no way makes fun of the people who believe in goblins and fairies and things. And of course, I would have considered all this completely ridiculous about 20 years ago. But since I've learned more about, you know, Iceland's attitude about there being, you know, fairies and stuff living in the hills, I now see this as maybe being, you know, not as entirely surprising a belief, you know, especially in the 1850s when this was done. But what just killed me about this play was that it was like the character Bunthorn from Patience had been plucked straight out of Gilbert and Sullivan and dropped into Norway. And this was the poet that you were mentioning.
Yeah, Paulson.
Yes, Paulson. This was Paulson. And his lines about being so in love with the nature of the true traditions of Norway, and then having his heart broken when he had discovered that his one true love was some sort of
she's a wood nymph, elf. Yeah.
And then he discovered that they had a tail, and this broke his heart. It just made me laugh so much because I haven't very much seen a character whose entire purpose is to, you know, draw attention to themselves and be self-serving and just egotistical beyond the bounds of the planet to hold. But he was acted so well. I was just falling over myself every time he was on stage, and every word that came out of his mouth was such a load. I was like in hysterics. And to make it even more fun, the guy, the brother of Julianne, what is his name?
Jürgen.
He's a Pratt. So both of the kids of Mrs. Berg are just intolerable, as it turns out. And so you can't kind of help but root for, you know, simple little Anne to actually have things work out well for her. So I actually got, you know, quite involved in trying to figure out, you know, when it was so clear that you wanted to have the, you know, uppity, sniffy, egotistical city girl matched up with the ridiculous, whiny, irritating poet, because you wanted to see, you know, Anne, who's, you know, loyal to her grandfather and good-natured and just perfectly decent, wind up with Johannes, who, you know, for all that he's in, you know, for all he starts out being not too nice because he doesn't seem to be very enthusiastic about this engagement, you know, you want to see them together. And I like, you know, these days having a goblin mess with the wine seems like just a reasonable way to get over getting people to like each other as anything else. So I completely bought the plot. You know, it didn't matter that it was supposed to be real. To me, the thing that was real underlying all of it was greed, which was Mama Berg. And in some ways, her with her sweet little pink house was almost like the witch trying to lure the children into the gingerbread house. She just was so selfish and unconcerned for her stepdaughter and the old man that she got saddled with when her second husband died. You know, she actually doesn't get, you know, her comeuppance per se, but I thought that it was a quite satisfying play, and it took real modern considerations and then gave it this wonderful folklore layer over everything that, you know, while I can't imagine necessarily buying it, you know, say on the stage at the National, that done in an intimate space like that, I was willing to enjoy the good performances and the comedy of the both the acting and of the plot itself, and had a good night. And also the bit where the two couples are having this sort of vision of what they're seeing on top of the mountain, Anne and Burke wind up experiencing all these, they see all these fairy tales actually really happening in front of them. And I enjoyed getting a little chance to have some exposure to Norwegian folk culture because I really like fairy tales. So I thought it was a very enjoyable show. You know, it wasn't very expensive, and that's important to me. But it was charming, and I was in no way shorted by any of the actors. I feel like they gave it 100%, and they were, you know, they were good, very good quality performers. And for all that you might look, say, at the Wikipedia article and think that this was a real negligible play, I think that A, if you enjoy Ibsen, or B, if you enjoy folk tales, that this would be the kind of play that you would really enjoy. And if you want to see someone being completely over the top, anyone who likes Patience by Gilbert and Sullivan, this is probably a very, very, very small slice of the theatrical going audience. But if you like Patience, then I think you have to see this play. It's funny because I actually checked because I thought maybe he had just lifted the character of Bunthorne entirely. But it's a 30-year difference. They have nothing to do with each other. But apparently the type that Bunthorne represented with the aestheticism in England of the 1880s was absolutely there happening in Norway in the 1850s. I would have just – that was quite a surprise for me. So I think that it was definitely an evening worth my time, and it was one of my highlights of my week.
Yeah, I should mention, because I like her a lot, Sarah Crowe played Mrs. Burke, and she did manage to make her somewhat sympathetic, although she is a bit of a monster.
Well, it's just, you know, wanting to have your daughter married well. That's not an unreasonable thing to want, especially, you know, this was the Victorian times in Norway. And if she had got her daughter married to someone who wasn't able to take care of her, she was going to have a lifetime of hardship. So I think there's an element of practicality there that, you know, I have to respect. So she was still in that Ibsen way. You know, she had very reasonable desires. They didn't necessarily make her an incredibly charming person, but she was realistic, and I thought she was a pleasure on stage, and she didn't seem like she didn't believe what she was saying, you know, and she looked good with the braids.
Yes, the costumes were a lot of fun. I thought, they are faintly ridiculous, especially Paulson's, but it did kind of work in the end, and it felt sort of suitable.
Yeah, I thought they just figured that they were going to, you know, turn the volume up to 11 just say, you know, this play's got some crazy things in it, so we're going to have a good time with it, and we hope you all have a good time at our show. And I did. Oh, also, the goblins were pretty cool. They played music throughout most of it, but also having them on stage and performing music helped make Anne's point of view about the world more believable, because the director is showing you that it's not just make-believe.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as-yet-unnamed London Theatre Podcast page in Facebook. On the web, we are ayu-londontheatre.org, and the podcast can also be found on iTunes, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.